Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello, welcome to The Gallery. Valentin Danens belongs to the generation of Belgian theatre makers who have entered the English-speaking world in the second decade of the 21st century thanks to the concerted efforts of the Belgian producer David Bowens of the Entour and Good fame, British producer Richard Jordan, and Theatre Royal Plymouth. Their platform, Big in Belgium, was first launched at the Edinburgh Fringe in 2013, a year after Danens' Big Mouth was presented as a test case and emerged successful. With Big in Belgium, Danens came back to Edinburgh in 2013 with Entour and Good's Fight Night, and then with another solo show, Small War, in 2014, before presenting Pardon in Cuffs in 2015 with his collective Skagen, to which he had belonged since graduating from drama school in 2000. In 2016, he performed at Edinburgh Fringe in Entour and Good's monologue World Without Us, before returning with another personal solo show, Unsung, in 2018. Although to some extent influenced by the Flemish wave of the 1980s, as we find out in this conversation, Danens and the others of his generation can be seen to have forged a new set of interests and aesthetics that distinguish them from those who came before them. In addition to a more explicit interest in politics and the audience engagement that marks this new Flemish wave, Danens' own work as a solo artist can be seen as additionally emblematic of reinventing the form of the theatre monologue. This conversation took place on Zoom on the 29th of May, 2020. The format of this conversation is we kind of retraced your steps as an artist and understand how any formal training you might have received has influenced your way of working and making theatre, and also how any other formative influences, just in terms of like popular culture or anything you've absorbed and internalized from your surroundings, might have influenced this particular approach to how you make theatre and performance. To go back to your early days, you trained as an actor. Where was it, in Brussels or in Ghent?
In Antwerp.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's quite a famous school in Belgium. It's the Royal Conservatory, and it was famous because it was headed by this monstre sacré, we say, this very well-known actress, pedagogue, a very important woman called Dora van der Groen. She was one of our finest actresses, but she was also maybe even more a very famous pedagogue because she created a method which is very different from the well-known American and English methods. I think if you would explain it a little bit, it had more to do with the likes of Artaud and Grotowski, the way she taught. And this woman has been of a gigantic influence on lots of theater groups of my generation and even older generations. For instance, we have in Belgium a lot of theater groups without hierarchy, so collectives we call them. And most of them are all of this same school where I come from. And it's like every class that finished theater school, and normally we only finish with 3-4 each year, starts a group, or lots of them have started a group. And some of those groups still exist and are very important to the Flemish theater scene. A group that you might know is called Stan. They play a lot in France. They play all over the world, but they're most popular in France. But like those, there are lots of them, and they're a bit older than we are. And Skagen is also one of those groups. And I guess for me, this collective was a very important way because I was kind of immature, I guess. I was very young when I was at theater school and I didn't get always what they were all talking about. And this collective gave me a way of finding my own voice because we started right away. And if I would have had to do it on my own, I would never have come to monologues like Big Mouth that I did, like that's now 10 years ago. So the education continued for me just being in this collective. And we have this funding system in Flanders, which is under pressure now and will hopefully stay. It's quite unique, where we got quite a lot of funding right from the start for just finding our own voice, working in a very small group, just 4 to 6 people, without hierarchy, without directors or scenic people or even technicians, maybe one technician, but most of the time we did everything ourselves. So we started to find our own things that we were good at. And that's some people are better in dramaturgy, other people are more interested in the technical side of it. So that's a bit how it worked and how my early career started.
Did you all study at Antwerp together, all of you who were in the collective?
So Skagen used to be 6 people. It was one class of this theater school.
Mm-hmm. And whenabouts was that you were at that school and that we founded the company?
We finished in 2000 the school and started right away. We actually started touring our final performance from the school under the wings of another company called De Cou, the cow. That's also a collective, a very small one, with just 2. Now there are 3 people. We were taught by one of the people of the cow, company the cow, and that worked really well. And this company decided to support this new founding company called Skagen, and they put us on tour, and that was the start of our company.
Was it that voice training was a particular aspect of the training you got with your professor?
No, it's hard to describe, of course, in 5 minutes, because she used methods from different areas. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's all about the world that you create, the imagination that you can share with an audience. For example, one of the texts that we worked on, theater text we worked on with this professor called Dora van der Groen, was A Lucifer by Vondel. It's a very old 18th century, in old Dutch, a language that is, even for me, very hard to understand. She wanted with us to work like 3 months on this one theater piece. And we only did like 1 scene. We could pick a scene because it had a lot of distance. Even if it was related to our language, it was not our language. And that distance created the possibility to create like a mind palace. It's about angels who have fights in heaven, actually. Mm-hmm. And so it was the perfect build up to make your imagination work on something that's not of your own world. I remember training on just like 3 sentences for hours. It reminded me a bit of a movie called Whiplash, in which the drummer is trained, and every time he hits a beat too slow, the teacher says, too slow, too slow. And I had a very similar experience, like I would only say 2 words, and the teacher would go, no, that's not it. No, it's not there. And you say again those 2 words, you say them a bit different, you get totally mad because you don't understand what the woman wants. But in the end, of course, and it takes a lot of time, you kind of start to understand that you can project an image in the space that you share with an audience. And that is related to voice, but it's more a mental thing that in front of you, when you're on a stage and you share a space with an audience, you can actually put certain areas over there in the space and just mentally project them somewhere. And it creates an emotion, a very different emotion than when you all keep it here. And that's very quickly a bit explained how her training worked.
Great. That's really helpful and very important as well for what we are actually working on. What we saw of your work in the UK context, the temptation is to associate it with the trends that we've witnessed in the UK in the early 2000s, which were to do with verbatim theatre. To what extent was there a trend of verbatim theater or documentary theater in Belgium in the early 2000s?
It's quite common, I would say, or a lot more than what I saw from a UK theater. Since we don't have a big tradition, that's also a good point for us Belgians, or let's keep it to Flemish people, because I'm not that much into French speaking theater in Belgium. But we don't have any Molière or Shakespeare or Goethe. We have this Vondel that I just talked about, Lucifer, but that's like, you can do it once and then you're finished with it. It's not like we have this big tradition. So in that way, I think Flemish theater has been since the 80s much more experimental and looking for new ways to make something that defines us, that defines Flemish people. And it's a lot related with the dance movement in Flanders, which is also very big. It's, I don't know if it's known in UK, but we have like a lot of dance companies that are touring all around. I guess the most important or most famous one is Rosas from Anne-Theresa de Keersmaeker. And for instance, Anne-Theresa de Keersmaeker, her sister is called Jolente de Keersmaeker, and she's then again part of STAN, which is another collective that was 10 years ahead of us. So it's a very small art world here in Flanders, and we influence each other a lot, I guess. And the one thing that keeps us going is always looking for something new, for new ways of performing theater. And also, we don't like traditional theater. And that really started in the 80s. It was kind of a crisis here as well, because lots of people like traditional theater. But like in the 80s, we had all these new collectives, but also new directors like Ivo van Hoof, who came along, Luc Perceval, Dirk Tange. I can name 10 of them that work internationally. And they all like, they did like these very new adaptations of classic plays, or they made totally different plays that didn't have a classic play as the start of their project. Also, they put their self forward. They didn't have a lot of respect for when they did an old play. It was like, it was all about them. It's about Ivo van Hove, who uses Euripides to say something about society today. So this movement became big and was a big influence from the 80s on, when I was still very young, of course. But that continued going. And because it went well, also internationally, it was recognized, this movement. I guess we were all very much influenced by it, and also very much aware that if we want to make a difference, we should not do it by doing Shakespeare as good as possible, or but just try to follow our own personal, what it means to me, what am I in society? So the personal is very important in Flemish theater. And so the documentary side of it is close to that thought, that that you always start from yourself, what surrounds you, what you are annoyed by, what you see on television. It can be anything. So it's a very free and liberated mind in our, we think it is. Some people disagree, of course.
When did you actually make your first piece that we might consider to belong to this genealogy of documentary theater? And was Big Mouth the first one that used that interest in voice and testimony?
Yes, it was. What I learned in this collective, and what we are famous about in Flanders with the plays we have made since 2000, and so a lot of plays, like 30 plays probably, is that we use a lot of collage, the technique of collage. So we stick stuff together from anywhere. We've once did a real play, that's it. And all the rest was like more adaptations, collage. We made an adaptation of The Pest by Camus, for instance, but we did it with a lot of video. So we were playing in front of a blue screen, and we were projected in a movie on top of us. And that was like in 2010, I think. So that's like long ago. So we always looked for different ways of doing stuff. Big Mouth is also a collage of speeches. So the system of collage we used like already in school. It's a very typical thing for our company. We're, I guess, a bit known for that, that we always pick from different things and put them together in a kind of surprising way.
Mes chers compatriotes, mes frères de race, mes frères de lutte, vive l'indépendance et l'unité africaine! Vive le Congo indépendant et souverain!
wanna live in America. Okay, buy me in America. Everything's free in America. For a small fee in America. I wanna live in America. Okay, buy me in America. Everything's free in America. For a small fee in America.
Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty. We are free at last. We are free at last.
I had prepared another speech for this evening, but I have some very sad news for all of you here. Martin Luther King was shot and killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. In these difficult times, it might be a good idea to ask ourselves, what kind of a nation we actually are?
What kind of a nation we actually are? I wanna live in America. Okay, by me in America.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but that doesn't matter with me now, cause I've been on the mountaintop and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but we, as a people, will get to the promised land. My land, sweet land of liberty, land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims' pride, from every mountainside let it rain. Free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
I wanna live in America, okay, by me in America.
I'm so mean, I make medicine
so
sick.
So mean, I make medicine
so
sick.
So mean, I make medicine
so
sick.
We're not Americans.
Mean, I make medicine
sick. We're Africans.
Mean, I make medicine sick.
We're Africans who happen to be in America.
We were kidnapped and brought to America. If you're interested in freedom, you'll have to fight for that freedom.
I'm young, I'm handsome, I'm pretty, I'm fast.
Handsome, I'm pretty, I'm fast.
I can possibly be beaten. I've wrestled with an alligator. I've wrestled with a whale. Only yesterday I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick.
I wanna live in America. Okay, by me in America.
I did not have a sexual relation with that woman.
Happy birthday, Mr. President.
Today man holds in his mortal hands the power to abolish all forms of human poverty and the power to abolish all forms of human life.
I wanna live in America, okay, by me in America.
I love my two little girls more than anything, but I'd rather see them die today, still believing in God, than have them grow up under communism and die one day no longer believing in God.
Fly me to the moon,
fly
and let me
play
to
the among the stars.
Let me play to the moon,
let me see what spring is like on Jupiter.
Why oratory? How did that idea come to you?
It was my first monologue. I never done a monologue or a solo play, even not in school. And I guess it goes back till when I was 16 and I had a very good teacher in school. Not a theater teacher, just a normal school. I got fascinated by the idea that you can change the course of the world just by opening your mouth. When you're in the fifth grade in Belgium in school, it's called the retorica. That year, you're focused on the power of language and on all kinds of literature, but also on speech. For instance, the Goebbels speech that I use in Big Mouth, I read it first when I was 16 years old in class. And I was amazed by it because also I really liked it. I thought it was beautifully written. And of course, the outcome was terrible. It was very racist, but it had these long sentences, difficult sentences that I could get. And there's an audio tape of it, and you can hear the entire sport palace shouting back when he asks, "Wollt ihr den totalen Krieg?" And the whole crowd goes mad. It was almost like a pop concert, I think, or it attracted my attention, and I started to study it a little bit and get to know the speech, how come it works this well. And I guess that was the first thing where I got in contact with speech. Then another thing is American culture. American culture has always been important in the work of Skagen because we might be the first collective in Belgium that focuses more on popular media, where the others are more into really theater literature. And we were like the first ones who started doing scenes from a sitcom in the middle of a Greek play, or do scenes from movies or child's programs on television that we copied. So we had this interest not only in books and serious literature, but also just the popular culture. And I personally was very into American culture, like lots of people, so much that I sometimes thought that I'm also an American citizen in the way, if I look at my bookshelf still today, if I look at my music collection, the movies I like, I can easily say like 70% is American. I know much more about American culture than French culture. And France is just next to us. And it's a very big culture, of course, which is much more important to the generation who is older to me. But so that was the other thing, that in American culture, speech is very important. So I started to look at all these other speeches. And the thing about Americans is that they don't have this relativism that we have inside us, or this introvert thing. Everything is out. It's never big enough, and it's very theatrical as well to use. I guess those two things, my fascination for speech in the way that you can just change the course of the world by opening your mouth. And on the other hand, the American culture that has a beautiful tradition in speech, but also the speech changed a lot since the 60s, and it had to be shorter and just to have one-liners. I think those two things were like the starting point of Big Mouth. When I was about to do something alone for the first time, it was also very important, because in a collective, you always work together. Even when there's only one person on stage, there's a collaboration. And for this one, I remember saying to my fellow colleagues, I want to do this on my own. I don't want any interference. Just come and see the premiere on that date, which was hard for them to understand. I just wanted to feel what I was able to do without negotiating everything, because that's another downside from a collective, that everything you have to discuss. There's no hierarchy, there's no director. So every even good idea gets smashed sometimes because you're not able to explain it in a way that you can persuade the others to go with this idea.
The way that the piece comes across, it looks like vocal mimicry comes easily to you. Is that the case, or was it a product of hard work, kind of getting yourself to sound like the various people whose speeches you did?
There's some mimic work, but I also had from the start, I'm not gonna pretend to do JFK, for instance. It didn't have to be a show about mimicking, look how good I can do someone. And for instance, a lot of speeches were done very differently. Like I mentioned before, the Goebbels speech, like the center bit of the show, for me, he shouts all the time. It's like this German shouting, the cliche we have of Nazi propaganda. The key for me was that I could do something different with it. And I did it very softly spoken. I edited the speech more to the women, because it's a speech where he addresses the women. And I did it very softly spoken. And I think the speech is even better now than when Goebbels did it, because you get not in a way that he could persuade people, because that was very magic, I guess. But just in the way that you hear what he actually says. When you're not yelling it, you get to see how beautifully written it actually is, how well it is put together.
How long did you work on that piece?
Very short in a way and very long in another way. I promised myself to read a speech each day for a year long, because I wanted to work intuitively, something that I had missed working in this collective where you have to discuss everything. And I thought, if I'm just going to read every day one speech, it's like eating a whale. You just start bite by bite. Just by reading a speech a day and put them on stacks, I was hoping that they would start communicating in some way, which happened after a while. It was stressful at some moments that I thought it's never gonna work. But so I took a lot of time, a year, to just find the speeches that I wanted to work with and look at, like this speech of King Baudouin, it was just 3 weeks before the Congo speech of Lumumba, the independence speech. And Baudouin, the King Baudouin, was there when he spoke this independence speech. When I read it, there was months between those speeches, but at the dates, there was only 3 weeks. And that's how those two speeches came together. The Goebbels speech is similar. with Patton's speech, that has also the D-Day speech. So it's about the same time frame, and they're just on the other sides. Patton is very aggressive, while this Goebbels uses very long sentences. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit how the play intuitively came together. But then really working on it, we only had like, 6 weeks, I think. I had 3 weeks with the technician to the premiere. It went really quickly.
And at what point did you decide to use the loop station? Was that there at the beginning when conceiving this piece? Or
yes. The one thing that was very important to me, because it was a show about what you can do with your mouth, is that I could do it all live and nothing was pre-recorded. But of course, it was manipulated in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So I thought of doing all these speeches in one mix. And I thought, it's not going to work like doing speech after speech. People will need some time to just sit back and grasp on what they've just heard. So I came up quite easily with this idea of putting like small sounds, little songs, to put a bit of time frame of the speech that was going to come, or the speech that they've just heard, just to have these intervals that could also talk to the heart and not use the brains all the time. I didn't know what I was going to sing, but I've always been quite a singer. I mean, not a very good, well, I'm okay with front singing, but I've always got harmonies in my head, or even when I hear a song on the radio, I always try to look for a second voice. So that comes quite natural and easy and quickly to me.
Have you had training as a musician?
No, not really. No. As a kid, I learned the notes and I was in a choir for several years. I played a little bit of guitar, but I never did really serious musical training.
In terms of the stagecraft for that piece, I saw it in Soho Theatre. What I've seen in terms of a video of that piece is, it looks like you have a really long desk and it looks like you're in a laboratory of some kind.
Yes.
Was that incidental or deliberate?
No. I was looking for a co-producer. Skagen still hasn't got a lot of money, but then back in the days, for every production, we needed at least one co-producer. And we had this relation with a theater in Leuven. Leuven is a university town in Belgium, the biggest university town in Belgium. And they have this beautiful hall where they used to cut up animals and stuff. And it's a lecture hall that is really old, in old wood. And it was just made for that venue. I wasn't planning on touring yet or anything. The theater in Leuven is next to this auditorium. It's actually in the same building. I just proposed maybe I can open the academic year, which opens at the end of September in Belgium, with this show, which will probably relate to students. And they got it and said, that's a really good idea. Let's try it. Word of mouth spread really quickly, and I only did six shows. That was it. And then I started only a year after that on making a version in other lecture halls through Flanders, so not in theaters. And I only played it in the beginning. I only wanted to play in lecture halls, so it became a little bit of fun for me as well to come in these spaces I had never been before.
So did you ever think of the piece as a lecture performance?
Yes, you could see it as a very quickly and very subjective history through political speech, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of people, it works that way. I mean, it was, of course, very successful, but it was maybe even more successful to students and young people, like 16-year-olds, who have to study Greeks in school but are never really into it or don't know why. And just by hearing the Socrates, and then, of course, some good teachers went to see the show with their children and then gave lessons about Socrates afterwards. And so it was a good companion with intellectual practice on different levels. But it's also a bit like when you go to a pop concert and you have a song, it takes 3-4 minutes, then you have another song. The speeches, at least in Flanders, it was less abroad, but in Flanders, everyone knows it. Something about the speech, like the King Baudouin speech, is of course not known outside Belgium, but in Belgium most people know about what happened when I was young, when our king resigned. But the speech was never spoken. It was a speech that was spoken only in the parliament, And so it was never made public. And I found this speech through a politician. And so it was kind of revealing as well. That's something that I always missed, of course, when playing abroad. For some young people, it was a bit like a pop concert. Even when you don't like a speech, it only takes 4 minutes and then another one starts. So it attracted lots of different people on different levels.
Had you used Loop Station before, or did you use it for the first time for this?
Yeah. Yes, the first time. So it's was quite hard because I knew some musicians who worked with it. I knew a violin player who makes concerts with just her violin, and she beats on the violin and that gets into loop. But it's always a loop in the bar. So you start with a tempi and then you have to keep it tempi. And for what we did, it had to be a little bit more sophisticated, that we could change from chords that wasn't in the same beat. And so it took quite a lot of time to figure it a bit out. In a way, we weren't on top of our things back when we started with these loops.
When you say we, you mean your technician?
Yes. Me mm-hmm. and Jeroen, the technician, yeah.
And then Small Wars was the next piece that we saw, at least, which kind of works in an interesting way in relation to Big Mouth, because in some ways it continues that theme of working with found documents. But in other ways, there is a lot more complex approach to its visual content and the proliferation of characters that we see on stage. How did that come about?
I was playing a lot of Big Mouth then in 12. I got a little bit annoyed as well, which is a kind of a diva thing, because it went really well and everybody was happy. But during this show, I said these terrible things. I let people into war. I invited people to death in a way, but still everyone was very excited after these shows. It was like the one thing that I wanted to show, that a language can put people in the wrong direction. And they didn't get that, or they got it, but they were mostly excited by just the virtuosity of the show. And I started to think about a counter piece to Big Mouth that became Small War, because I wanted to show the victims of all these speeches. I guess that's how it started. I started making ideas for this show that would talk about the small people, the victims of those big politicians. I wanted to make a show that didn't relate in any way to a politician, that only had testimonies of soldiers, of nurses that actually had to do the wars those people were talking about in Big Mouth. We also had the 100-year First World War. I grew up in the area where it was fought a lot. In my class, when I was young, I still had farmer sons who once in a while find these bombs on their field while plowing. I was always fascinated by the First World War because it was in a way close by. It was also the first industrial war. Chemist warfare was invented then. The first war with planes, a tank was invented in the First World War. So the wars we do today are still very much similar to this First World War in the way how they are done. And then I started reading diaries of nurses. First, I started with nurses for some reason. Ellen LaMotte was the most important one. She's an American nurse who came all the way to Flanders to help. Enid Bagnol is a French nurse. And both of them, they also write beautifully and very hard, very cynical. In their diaries, you see them like turn around and just day after day, they start with all of the hope and then it gets terrible. And they're very honest about it. It was also like if Big Mouth was very male, masculine. There's even just one woman in it and she's also half masculine. It was also critique on the show that it didn't had any serious women in it. I wanted in Small World to show like the feminine side as well. So I decided to play a nurse, something I always had wanted to play a woman.
Mm-hmm. There was a boy. A very strange, enchanting boy. They said he traveled very far, very far, over. over land and sea, a little shy and sad as I, but very wise was he. And then one day, one magic day, he passed my way, and while we spoke of many things, fools and kings, this he said to me: the greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return.
I would like to know a little bit more in terms of the decisions you made around the mise-en-scène for that piece, the use of the screens and so on. And I was rereading my notes in relation to that piece as well, and I was remembering, you know, a scene which was quite inventive where a dead soldier dictates his letter to his unborn son to the nurse, which was a very beautiful lyrical moment that you constructed out of this material that had started off as being factual. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about some of those decisions around the construction of this piece.
I got very fascinated by trying to make a play that was in everything opposite Big Mouth. So trying to make a counterplay, male, female, but also Big Mouth has enormous dynamics. It goes very soft, goes very hard. It's very musically. And to relate to this war piece, I got very fascinated by reading about the First World War, about the monotonous of it. The soldiers waiting for 3 weeks in the mud, nothing happening, and being cold and rats everywhere and being annoyed. And then we always imagine war like we see in movies, with bursting of bombs and shooting and running around. But most of the time it's like waiting and being agonized by fear. And this traumatic feel of stillness, I wanted also in small war as a opposite the dynamics of Big Mouth. It was very hard for me to do, because as an actor, you want to put dynamic into something. But I said to myself, try to keep the same pace in everything you say, everything you do. It has to have the same pace. So I didn't want to make a show about bombs and explosions and big things, but the trauma, the nightmare, the stillness. Also, like a record, at the end of the record, the screeching that you hear. That was one of the first sounds that I wanted to have in Small World, the record that keeps on playing after the music. So there's a lot of this sound in the show, but it's very subtle. Most people won't notice it. And also in a way, like since First World War, English soldiers, and now I think most of the soldiers, are obliged to write a letter to their family, to their friends, in case they would die, if they would go to war. So you have all these young kids that have to imagine themselves, okay, I'm dead now. What should I write to my mom, to my... And I found this idea very strong. I found a lot of literature that put together these letters. And so the letter you mentioned about this soldier writing to his unborn son is one of those. It's also documentary. It's not like I invented this letter. Also, at the end of the show, you see his name. I forgot now his name, but you have subtitles at the end. And I mentioned all the soldiers that I copied in the show.
Mm-hmm. But the way in which that scene was staged was that because you used the screen, we had you playing the soldier on screen, dictating to the nurse on stage, who is also played by you. Presumably you again worked on this show completely on your own, did you? You did, yes. Maybe with some technicians.
Oh, just one. It was a nightmare. I totally underestimated the amount of work. But yeah, just with two people, me and the technician, the same one from Big Mouth, we made the show. Yeah.
Right. And so now there was a visual element to it, whereas in Big Mouth, there was just sound. Now you felt you had
that's,
to have
that's the thing I forgot to say. Mm-hmm. Like, so Big Mouth was about sound, and I wanted in everything to be opposite. This show should be about what you see as well. So I wanted to do with video what I did with audio. All the soldiers are looping all the time. It's like you take 3 seconds and they go, and you keep repeating all those 3 seconds. So they move a little bit and they stay alive. The amount of speeches relates to the amount. If you would put the two texts next to each other, you will see that the amounts are about the same and the way it is structured, but in a very different dynamic.
Did you get a different kind of response from the audience?
Yes, time? Very, very different. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a lot of people who were saying they were disappointed, but I guess lots of people were disappointed after Big Mouth. And I did like this very tragic, slow piece where people went out in silence. A bit what I missed in Big Mouth, that everyone was very happy with the show. So in a way, I made my point, but still I was a bit surprised by how the reactions were very different. But then I started touring it internationally. And then Small War in some places, I did it together with Big Mouth. And for some reason, Small War in some places worked better. Like I did it in Hong Kong, I remember. And for some reason, all these people were in tears after the show. And while Big Mouth works in every culture, almost every culture, I did it in India, I did it in Iran. Small War is very different from areas.
And then you took your interest in voice and working with testimony back to your colleagues at Skagen Ensemble. And you made a piece together, which was based on the testimonies of Small Criminals.
Yes,
right.
It's actually a documentary by Raymond Depardon, which is a magnum photographer as well, but he made beautiful documentaries, and one is called Des Lits Flagrants, and it's on Christmas Eve, and he just points a camera in Paris at the police office in the basement where people who did something stupid or mostly small crimes. They get there, and then the prosecutor decides whether they have to be in front of a judge or they can go because it's their first time that they did something, or it gets postponed to a later day. And those conversations were recorded, and we started with this documentary on making this show. You say it in a way like I did Big Mouth, Small War, then I went to my company, but it's not like that. Like we do so much plays. We do 2 to 3 plays a year with my company. So this one, it started with me. It always starts with someone. So it was like more my idea, more my play, but it was made in a very collective way. It was less a show that was only mine. You understand? And it was mm-hmm. a show like we did several ones. So in our trajectory, it's mm-hmm. not that different.
Okay, that's great. Thank you for correcting me on that. Because
oh,
yes,
no,
you're
no.
right.
It's obvious.
No, but you're right. I might have perceived this in a linear way, but actually you probably had a concurrent number of trajectories working at the same time. What was your kind of intention with making Pardon in Cuffs in terms of the form? What was it that you wanted to do with this documentary material that the actual screen documentary wasn't doing?
Yes, the main thing for me was I was very fascinated by these people who are at a point, it's life or death almost. It's like they have to lie, they have to try to defend themselves, say they have done nothing, find out reasons why they did it because they had a bad education or a bad upbringing. And so I saw these people struggling at one side, and at the other side you see this bureaucratic prosecutor who has all the power, and I find it very shocking to see those two against each other, who's in a routine as well. This prosecutor, all night people come in and he doesn't really care a lot, he or she. I wanted to tell something about that, just the power differences, and that you get maybe sympathy with both of them because they're both in a position. you feel it's not fair, and even if they've done a criminal act, you can see how the world is not fair to different people, and how we all end up in a position and we try to make best of it.
But what about these choices you were making that I seem to have perceived as going towards metaphorical representation of the kind of subtext of those texts, those found texts? How did that decision come about? To what extent is it something that is your company's methodology of working, an aesthetic approach? Or to what extent was it something that just emerged out of your grappling with this particular?
We always have a strong form layer in our shows. The clothes we wear, there wasn't a lot of form in a, but also we're on a swiveling round, and there's like music in between, the prosecutor playing a keyboard and doing nasty stuff. It's to create this dreamlike layer, but also by representing people in different clothes, show their difference in stature, but also like create a special night out or something. Like we go to the opera, and that's the how people dress then. So it's something intuitive as well. It's not like very political. It's more to create a distance from reality, which the documentary is very close to reality, and to theatralize this documentary material. We always look in forms for dreamlike tactics to show a different perspective on realistic material. We tend to make sure that people don't get involved on a naturalistic way, like you would if you would see Death of a Salesman. Everything is done that you get sympathetic with the main character, and we always try to create a distance that you see the actor much more than the character. That's a very Skagen thing that we always do. We always hope for the people to have some more distance to see the bigger thing.
Also, I think the significance of that is something to do with the way in which that phase of interest in documentary theatre has gone very much in this direction of wanting to be as faithful as possible to, you know, the real life subjects whose stories these were. And your approach seems to kind of make a very conscious departure from that in saying, yes, there is this material that is drawn from real life, and then this is theater, you know, we are putting it in a theater context.
We want people to see the manipulation that we do. Mm-hmm. And the manipulation is actually the most important thing. We want people to tell something about what we think about a certain subject. We never want to have people in a way that they are mostly into the drama of the main character. We always hope that they have a broader view on what they've seen, because we think, well, movie has taken a little bit of theater in a way that they're much better in creating with lots of soundtracks, and that you go into the journey of the main character. And we think in the years that we are working now, well, theater hasn't got that main position anymore in telling a story the way movie can much better. So that's also a reason why we try to have another way. It's also much harder, like when you're in a cinema, you really get sucked by this big screen and you're really into it. While in a theater, my opinion, you never forget that you're in a theater. You hear people coughing, you feel a space. So it's a totally different relationship to the story.
Great, great, excellent. Thank you. Then Unsung came to Edinburgh a couple of years ago, 2018. And Unsung was your other solo show, your new solo show, that seems to have left this idea of documentary material behind. And it's something you've written from scratch.
It's actually very documentary, but you can't tell, probably. But every scene that's in there is based on a real-life politician. Maybe that's the most well-known to you. You have this famous brother battle between Gordon Brown and Tony Blair. That's like the second scene in the show. I'm playing in a restaurant, and I'm actually saying, as Tony Blair to Gordon Brown, that it would be much better if I'm the one who starts be the head of the Labour Party, because the elections are coming. And so it's actually all snippets based on, there's an entire speech of Trump in there where he actually says nothing. Some people noticed that was Trump, much older Mitterrand is in there. Like, I don't know if you remember, but I had these small videotapes that I had with my mistress.
Yes.
And like 4 or 5 years ago, the letters of the French president, Mitterrand, were released, Lettres à Anne, letters to Anne, his mistress. He had, and Mitterrand was known for a snobbish, well, not snobbish, but a very harsh person. While in these love letters to Anne, he's very lyric and very French with lots of romantic sentences. So it was actually less obvious, and we didn't say the names of everything.
Yes.
And I also wrote it together with the speechwriter of Verhofstadt, which is like our biggest politician. He's now at European Parliament leading the Liberals. I got to know this person who is a political animal and knows all the biographies of political people in the history. So it was written together with him. It was also like snippets, but like less cited.
When you turn on your television and you watch some dishonest news, you hear this happened and this happened. What did actually happen? Well, he decided to run and he lost. That's what happened. I advised against it, but he went along anyway. And when he had to give his congratulatory speech addressing me, he was booed by the entire party. I mean, literally, thousands and thousands of people, the entire room. There wasn't one single person, one single, they might claim, we have no unity, no unity. There wasn't one single person in the room not booing. Yeah, I hate to say it, but he may have well ruined his political career. I feel so bad for him. It's terribly bad. But he'll come and endorse over a little while to endorse me, pledging full support. It's not like he has another option, has he? But I want his endorsement. I don't need his endorsement. I have such great endorse. I don't give a rip about his endorsement, so leave it behind you, man. Sit back, stay home, relax, enjoy yourself. I knew his speech. They gave me his speech because when you go up there to speak, you have to give your speech in advance. You know, they don't want any surprises. And so they came over with his speech, said, it's a boring speech. Nothing good, nothing bad. He congratulates you on the victory. So they hand me over his speech. I read his speech. He gets up there, starts addressing his speech. And two sentences into it, he adds a tiny sentence. So he gets up there and adds a sentence, which could be viewed as a sly move, especially since what he was adding were lies, filthy lies. So he took the speech, and you're bound by that speech, just like you're bound by the pledge, you're bound by the pledge. So he took the finished speech that is on the autocues and stuff, started his speech, good evening, blah, 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 after which he threw in that rubbish that wasn't in his speech in the first place and then just continued his speech. Look, that to me is dishonorable. It's dishonorable.
Because you said that it was quite foundational for you as an artist in terms of the training you received to think about this communication with the audience. So we've touched on how the audience received Big Mouth and how the audience received Small War. We haven't quite talked about how the audience received Pardon in Cuffs, but how did the audience receive this latest piece? What was that particular relationship?
It was very well received. I think maybe this was the most popular in Belgium because, well, as you might know, we don't have a government for a year now after the last elections, and it was the same at elections before. And so people are very tired of our politics and have this very cynical feel about it. I wanted to show in this play, so we have all these debates on television and politicians like you have in every country, I imagine. But still, I think the standard in like most English debate political programs is much higher than the ones we have in Belgium. We also have extreme right-wing politicians that are in those debates. It's a battle, and it hardly talks about any real subject. It's just about winning. And I wanted to stress that, that a politician, and I focused on like the last weeks before an election, it's also in the play, like a politician needs to win the elections first, and then he can start with the content, what he really means. But to win an election, it's not about sincerity, it's not about good ideas, it's about knowing how to manipulate the mass, or to look where can we still get votes, which is the audience that is still doubting. Let's not work on the people that are already won for our ideas, so forget about them. So it's about mathematics, it's about statistics. And I guess I wanted to show the loneliness of a politician in this position. It's also a bit a sad thing. You have decided, or you have put forward to lead a party or go into elections. It's a very big responsibility. And you really don't have time in debates to actually say something about education, or how you would reform the public transport or something. It's mostly about, I can say something about public transport, but I can only say something that I know I'm going to win voters with. I'm not saying anything new, of course. But this show, the main thing for me was to not say anything about a real subject. Pensions comes along, but you never know what this politician really thinks. And that was picked up really well in Belgium.
In a way, it also, this piece exists within the continuity as well of your previous work, which was to do with like Big Mouth and the political speeches. I mean, was that a conscious kind of like next step for you?
No, because I did a lot of plays in between it. In UK, it was like much more related to Big Mouth than it was in Belgium. It didn't get related that much because there were lots of other shows in between.
Yes. What else has happened since, and are you working on, and to what extent are you still interested in some of these aspects of working with speech and verbatim testimony in your work?
To be honest, I'm a bit tired with it, so I'm not focusing on it a lot. I've always been a very curious person. I'm much interested in history. I'm much interested in politics, on the mechanics of politics more than the real politics. So surely those main themes will continue in my work, but I'm trying to avoid the speech area. I'm working now on a play about artificial intelligence, in which I'm gonna play a robot. Not a robot that you can tell I'm a robot, but more like that me as a person was put together by all the technology that exists today. So there's a robot that can help people in a hospital with lifting people in their bed. There's another one who knows when they have to take their medicine. I'm trying to imagine if we would put all this intelligence that exists now and is all over the world and put it together in one robot, how I would talk to you as in person. I'm also imagining addressing the audience just as a person. It's with the KVS, it's not with Skagen, it's KVS is the Royal Flemish Theatre in Brussels. And we were about to do with Skagen our biggest play, probably, I mean, on a level of actors with 13 actors. It's called Het Gezin van Pamel. It's the family of Pamel. It's an old naturalistic play from 1903, a Flemish play about farmers in a crisis and the bourgeoisie that milks them and like treats them as slaves. But now with Corona, we were not allowed to play it, especially not with 13 people on a stage. So I'm trying now to make an adaptation that I'm doing it on my own, like the whole family. And that again would then still be related to Small War in a way, that I would use the same techniques, but like 2.0, like try to level it up a little bit.
Yes.
So that I would try in every act to play one of the characters live, of the farmer's life, and the other ones would be projected and I would record them in advance. So that's a thing I'm thinking about now. And that would be kind of interesting in if you see my work as what you describe it, that would be like in the same line, or it would be another interesting add to
the... Great. I see the AI piece as being part of your trajectory as well, because you introduced it as being about how a robot talks to an audience, you know. So, you know, I'd be really interested to see it in some way at some point. Thank you very much, Valentin. That's really helpful and really insightful.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.